Yeah, we used gift cards everywhere we went, and we thank you for that. Just in case you don't know, you have heard me talk about a former student of mine who has been an astronaut. Part of the reason for our trip, the main reason we were absent, was that he is retiring. I don't think it's fair for a former student of mine to retire before I retire. But he's taking retirement from NASA, and one of the things we found when we were there, the people who spoke from NASA, he has transformed the NASA Education Office in his 4 or 5 years of being in charge of that particular group, and has done things that look like they will have lasting impact. And we heard a lot of that from various people. I would say watch for this young man. He grew up in Lynchburg. He's moving back to Lynchburg, and there was a hint that maybe he'll run for office sometime. I think that would be an interesting thing to see happen. Secondly, and again, if you see something, some things that I post in various social media, you may have seen this already. We got stuck in traffic on Interstate 81 just across the border into Tennessee, about 10 miles into Tennessee. We decided to pull off at the exit we came to because the next exit was 8 miles further and the traffic was simply not moving. We knew that there were major roads about 20 miles or 15 miles to the right and left of the interstate. If we could just get to one of those, we decided to go to the one on the right. And we didn't have maps of sufficient detail to know how to do this, so I made left turns when we hadn't made one in a while. We made right turns when we hadn't made one in a while. Tried to get to this road. We ended up on this very narrow road, and on that road there was a well-fed woman with a Cocker Spaniel trying to dodge the pickup truck that was coming at high speed in the opposite direction. And we pulled over and asked her, could she give us an idea of how to get to 11W? And she said, well, there's lots of turns in the way, but if you just go on down this road a little ways, you'll come to a place where there's a small bridge that goes over a creek, a very narrow bridge that goes over a creek. Just beyond that, there's a big new subdivision. If you go about 3 or 4 houses, there's a road. That road will take you across the subdivision, and there'll be a major road on the other side, and using that road, you'll get pretty close. Okay. And she said, as you get a little further, you'll pass the Eastman plant. Now, I don't know if that phrase, the Eastman plant, means anything to you guys, but out of all the students that I have taught, there's a student who's probably in the top 10 of my favorite people. Not necessarily because she was a good student, although she was, but because she was funny as the dickens, sarcastic as the day is long, came out of New Jersey and had many of those appealing qualities. And she was a PhD chemist working at Eastman. We got a little bit further down this road and we found two narrow one-lane bridges, both within sight of each other. As a dear friend of mine yesterday said, well, you came to a fork in the road and you took it, right? And I said, yes, we chose the right-hand side. There was immediately a big subdivision on our right. We found the road that went across that subdivision. We'd gone across the subdivision, started to turn left, and it occurred to me, these houses look familiar. I think I've seen these on her postings. So I called her, told her a couple of the streets that we'd gone past, and she says, you just drove past my house. Come back. Oh, wow. I haven't seen this girl in person in 10 years, I think, and we spent 35, 40 minutes in her house. And it was absolutely great. It was just wonderful. And I don't know why the interstate was backed up, but it helped make the trip. It was wonderful. I hope that you have accidents like that sometime. Now, that has nothing to do with what we're doing. Don't sweat that. But I would like to give you a sense of where we are. We have been going through the history of what's called the Kingdom Period. Saul, David, Solomon, and then the kingdom split. The northern kingdom, usually referred to as Israel. The southern kingdom, usually referred to as Judah. The southern kingdom, the one or two tribes, the Northern Kingdom, 10 tribes. The Northern Kingdom has been destroyed by Assyria. The Southern Kingdom has just been destroyed by Babylon in the scheme of things. And we have gone through those books and have watched that process take place. God has sent his prophets. For the most part, they are ignored. God has had kings come up. For the most part, they were ineffectual or awful or worse. A few exceptions. And if you look in detail, you start to see evidence of how bad things were. As we finish that, the last three or four verses of 2 Chronicles are the first three or four verses of Ezra. And Ezra is at the end of the exile period. They were exiled for 70 years. In the book of Jeremiah, we will come across a verse or two where Jeremiah says, this is what's going to happen. You're going to be in exile for 70 years, and then you're going to be allowed to come back. And so rather than go straight into Ezra, we're stopping for a moment, and we're going and looking first at the book of Jeremiah. After that, we will look at the book of Lamentations. And after that, I don't know what we will look at, but we're going to look at a few more things that are either side notes, sidebars in the kingdom period or in the period of the exile. And then eventually we'll come back to Ezra and Nehemiah. So far, okay? All right. We have made it seven chapters into Jeremiah, and we finished chapter 7 the last time we were together. I want to remind you in verse 30 of chapter 7, the tail end of what we looked at last time, God is speaking through his prophet Jeremiah, and he says, yes, the people of Judah have done what displeases me, the Lord declares. They have set up their horrors in the temple that bears my name to defile it. They have built the high places of Topheth in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to burn their sons and daughters, a thing I never ordered that never entered my thoughts. So now the days are coming, the Lord declares, when people will no longer speak of Topheth or the valley of Ben-Hinnom, but they'll call it the valley of slaughter. Topheth will become a burial ground for lack of other space. The corpses of these people will be food for the birds of the sky and the animals of the earth, and there will be no one to drive them off. I will silence the shouts of rejoicing and mirth and the voices of the bridegroom and bride in the towns of Judah, the streets of Jerusalem, for the country will be reduced to desert. Awful, awful things are coming. And Jeremiah is the one that God has selected to speak to his people during this time. That's what we're looking at. Okay? So let's start chapter 8. When that time comes, the Lord declares, something's going to happen. What's going to happen? All of you, your assignment was to read the rest of Jeremiah starting at chapter 8, so I'm sure you've all read this, except maybe our friends visiting today. What happens? I'm trying to give you time to scan it real quickly and pretend that you've read it. They're going to loot the tombs. They're going to pull the bones out of the tombs and scatter them around. You may remember that in Jewish custom, burial was supposed to take place the day that somebody dies. And once buried, they're supposed to stay buried. This is awful. Why would they go and do this? I've already given you the word. Did you hear it? I've been to a museum and I've seen the treasures of King Tut. Have you, some of you, been to see those? Why do we have those to look at today? Because somebody looted the tomb. The bones are not still where they were supposed to be. They've been taken out. We go and we look at them. There's protests that are going on in our country today with things that were taken from the Native Americans and put into museums in various places, and the Native Americans want them back. They're not supposed to be there. They're supposed to be here. And it's awful. But look at verse 2. God is speaking, and he's saying, I'm ordering this, and it's going to happen. They're going to be spread out before the sun and the moon and the whole array of heaven. Whose bones? Number one, the bones of the kings of Judah. Who else? Mine says the chief men, the bones of the priests. Does yours say the chief men? You skipped that when I asked you that. Does yours, officers, yours says? The priests, the bones of the prophets, and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, spread out before the sun, the moon, the whole array of heaven, whom they have, and mine has five verbs. Look at that list of verbs. Spread out on the ground before the sun and the moon and the whole array of heaven, whom they have loved and served and followed and consulted and worshipped. And they will not be gathered or reburied, but left lying on the surface like, mine has a powerful word, dung. Were you in the 8 o'clock service? Did you like the difference between pessimist and optimist among the little boys? I will say no more. If you weren't in that service, then you have something good to look forward to. Got to be one in here somewhere. Verse 3 is probably the most horrible verse in this whole part. What does it say? They will prefer death to life, all the survivors of this wicked race, wherever I have driven them. Starting in verse 4, the commentators say this is poetry. Jeremiah is trying to express what God is saying, and he expresses it almost in poetry. Now, what I want you to notice is I want you to try to notice, if you can, who is speaking. Verse 4, who is speaking? God is speaking through Jeremiah. Now watch how it works. Do you see how it works? You are to tell them, God says this, if somebody falls, can he not stand up again? Verse 10, who's speaking? This isn't Jeremiah. Look at verse 10. This is God speaking through Jeremiah. Verse 13, who's speaking? God is speaking. Verse 18, who's speaking? Verse 18, who is speaking? I think Jeremiah is speaking there. I ask you to consider that. Take a look at that. I'm asking you to do something, which is, if you haven't read it already, you've got to scan it real quickly. And this is what I want you to see. Chapter 9, verse 1, who is speaking? Actually, it's going to be verse 2, I think, in your translation. Chapter 9, verse 2. Chapter 9, verse 1, who's speaking? I think I've got it right. Is that who will turn my head into a fountain? My eyes into a spring of tears? That's what you got to watch for. You need to read at least closely enough to have a sense of who's speaking. It's almost always Jeremiah, but much of the time it's God speaking either to or through Jeremiah. But every once in a while, it's Jeremiah himself. And what's coming is a dialogue begins to be set up between Jeremiah and the Lord, and that dialogue is illuminating. It's a little more than interesting. I think it begins to reveal something. So let's back up. Verse 4 of chapter 8. Verse 4 of chapter 8. Back up to that. You are to tell them, and now I have secondary quote marks. You are to tell them, the Lord says this, if someone falls, can he not stand up again? If people stray, can they not turn back? I walked down the steps of Finchmore Farms yesterday as I was leaving. And I did what I almost always do these days. I have bifocals. I went slowly. I held onto an arm rail. And I made sure I didn't fall. If I had fallen, all kinds of bad things could have happened. But what would I have wanted to do? Get back up. I got stuck in the interstate traffic on Interstate 81. What was I trying to do when I left the interstate? I was trying to find a way to get back on the path to go where I was trying to go in the first place. Those two images are what God is using. God says, if you fall down, isn't it usual that you would get back up? If you lose your way, aren't you looking for a way to get back onto the path that was taking you where you wanted to go? And if you hear those two things, then the next sentence begins to make a different kind of sense. Why does this people persist in acts of infidelity? Why does Jerusalem persist in continuous infidelity? They are falling and they don't seem to want to get back up. They're getting off the path that they know they ought to be on. Why aren't they trying to get back on that path? They cling to illusion. They refuse to turn back. I've listened attentively, and they've never said anything about turning back. No one repents of wickedness, saying, "What have I done?" Each one keeps returning to the course, to the path that takes them away from where they ought to be going. And they do it like a horse charging into battle. God says, I look at the birds of the sky. They know when it's time to go from here to there, and they know the path that they ought to take. That's what it's saying. What birds does he mention?
Storks.
What else? Turtle doves. Swallows. Cranes. That tells you something about the birds that would have been in that area at the time. They all know the appropriate seasons. They all know the migratory paths. But my people don't know God's laws. They say, we're wise because we have God's laws. But it's been falsified by the ones that are charged with keeping it written down where people can see it. The wise are put to shame, alarmed, caught out, because they've rejected the Lord's word. What price is their wisdom now? And then comes the horrible statement of verse 10. Their family members are going to be made slaves to other people. Their fields are going to go to new masters. From the least to the greatest, they are all greedy for gain. Prophet no less than priest, all of them practice fraud. And then comes verse 11. Does anybody have that verse in the message? Y'all still sticking the muds with the older translations, huh?
I have the living.
Yeah, sure. What does it say?
They give useless medicine for my people's grievous wounds, for they assure them all is well when this isn't so at all.
Message, I think, says they put a Band-Aid. They put a Band-Aid on, and I forget the phrase they use, but essentially, if you've got a wound that is just pulsing blood, what have you hit? You've hit an artery, right? You've hit an artery. You've hit an artery, what do you got to do? You got to put a tourniquet on, you got to do all kinds of stuff, right? They're putting a Band-Aid on stuff like that. That's basically how the message works it. And they're saying, everything's fine, and everything's not fine. And you start to see the situation there. Jeremiah is a prophet, but there's a whole bunch of other people who say, we're prophets. And all of those others are saying, everything's going to be fine. We've got God's word. We've got God's temple. God's going to protect us. And Jeremiah is saying, that's not so. What you trust in is, back to verse 5, the middle of the page, illusion. Did you just have that word in the middle of verse 5? They cling to illusion. Deceit, you says. Illusion, I think, is a little better. Deceit captures it pretty well. Illusion may capture it a little better.
Just before that, why has this people of Jerusalem turned away in continual apostasy?
My translation uses the word infidelity there. Mm-hmm. What does that sound like?
In any kind of way.
Sounds like unfaithfulness in marriage. And an image that's overlaying all of this is the image of a marriage relationship, a relationship like marriage between God and His people, and turning away to false gods is the equivalent of adultery. Mm-hmm. It's a very ugly picture. It's a very ugly metaphor, but that's the metaphor that's being used. Without concern, my verse 11 says, they dress the wound of the daughter of my people, saying, peace, peace, when in fact there is no peace. They ought to be ashamed of their loathsome deeds, but not them. They feel no shame. They don't even know how to blush. And so as others fall, they too will fall. They will be put down when the time for punishing them comes. Verse 13, I will put an end to them. The end of verse 13 is a very interesting sentence of its own. There's a couple of sentences in verse 13. Can you find the last sentence in verse 13? What does it say?
They have squandered what I have given them.
What I have given them will pass away.
Oh, boy, that's different from mine. I was hoping it might be the same. No more grapes on the vine, no more figs on the fig tree. I have found them people to trample on them. Does that sound different from yours?
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah.
The invaders are coming, and when the invaders finish, everything's going to be trampled, including the people and the food. Verse 17. What does God say? I'm sending you, mine says poisonous snakes. Yeah, mine just says poisonous snakes. There was a time at the University of Richmond, I was reminded of that just before graduation. We had a reception for the graduating students, and some of our former students came back. They came back because their children were about to graduate. Yeah. And one of them was at the university when a particularly interesting biology professor did not get tenure and got word of it. He was a herpetologist. You know what a herpetologist does? Herpetologist studies snakes. This guy in his lab had snakes. Snakes. He had rattlers. He had cottonmouths. He had moccasins. He had everything. And when he didn't get tenure, he got drunk. And he set the snakes free. Came into Gottwald, 7-8 in the morning. Some of my friends come in early. Have you been to the 8 o'clock service? Ken Medema says at this particular point that the pastor was reading this morning, he says his staff turned into a hissing snake. What's the difference between a snake and a hissing snake? Hissing snake is mad. That building was full of hissing snakes. What did Moses do?
He ran.
And then God says, stop, go back, pick it up by the tail. Tom Stocks drifted right by that one. But Ken Medema in his song stops and says, Lord, you haven't been out here very long. Number one, you don't pick up a hissing snake. And number two, if you do, you don't pick it up by the tail. Okay. I'm sending you poisonous snakes against which no charm exists. What's that a reference to, folks?
No remedy.
Oh, come on, guys.
No remedy.
The name was Nehushtan, and we studied this. Some of you weren't here, you're off the hook, but the rest of you, you were here. We studied about Nehushtan. I was listening to a fellow that I think is very wise in a driving back and forth to work this last week. And the guy says, there are things that happen. You read about something and it makes no sense at all. And way later in the Bible, suddenly something's said and it starts to make sense. Nehushtan was one of those. You all really don't remember Nehushtan. I'm so sad. Again, giving you all the clues. It has to do with snakes. Moses is leading the children of Israel through the wilderness. They are complaining and complaining and complaining, and God says poisonous snakes. Fiery serpents, they're called. And when they bite the people die. And Moses makes a serpent out of brass and puts it on a pole and lifts it up, and those who look at the snake on the pole are healed. And that makes no sense at all. we came through the kingdom period, and what did we find under Hezekiah, I think it was? They're still worshiping that thing. They're still worshiping that thing. They called it Nehushtan. You know what Nehushtan means? I didn't know that until I listened to this guy this week. It means that brass thing, or that bronze thing. I forget which metal it means. They were still worshiping it. Hezekiah ground it up into powder and threw it away. Because Hezekiah says you're not supposed to worship the things that bring you to God. You're supposed to worship God. A lot you can do with that one. Okay? I'm sending you poisonous snakes against which no charm exists. There's no Nehushtan to take away this one. They will bite you, the Lord declared. Now Jeremiah reacts. Incurable sorrow overtakes me. My heart fails me. From the daughter of my people, the cry for help is ringing far and wide throughout the land. Quote, is the Lord no longer in Zion? Is her king no longer there? Question mark, end of quote. And then you hear, in mine it's in parentheses, you hear an echo of what God's been saying. You look at the book of Job, you'll see the same thing in the book of Job. Toward the end of the book of Job, as that mighty thunderstorm has crashed and God's voice comes through the tempest, as Job finally begins to speak, there's an echo of God's words put in parentheses in the middle of Job's words. That's what's happening here. Why have they provoked me with their idols, with their futile foreign gods? And then Jeremiah in verse 20 begins to quote the people again. Harvest is over, summer is at an end, and we have not been saved. Verse 21, the prophet is speaking from his heart. The daughter of my people wounds me too. All looks dark to me. Terror grips me. Is there no balm in Gilead anymore? Is there no doctor here? Why is there no progress in the cure of the daughter of my people? Who will turn my head into a fountain and my eyes into a spring of tears that I can weep day and night over the slain of the daughter of my people? What's Jeremiah's nickname? The weeping prophet. It comes from verses like this. Verse 9, chapter 9, verse 2, I think it is in your translation, is that right? Who will find me a wayfarer's shelter in the desert so I can leave my people far behind? All of them are adulterers. There's that metaphor again. A conspiracy of traitors. They bend their tongues like a bow. Not truth, but falsehood holds sway in the land. They go from crime to crime. But me, they don't know, the Lord declares. And all of a sudden, somewhere in there, it's switched back to God speaking and not Jeremiah speaking. And I wonder if that's some of the confusion in his own voice. He's hearing what God is saying and his own heart is responding. I'm not sure exactly what's happening, but suddenly right there, maybe he's simply remembering what God has said and quoting it. Don't trust a brother. For every brother aims but to supplant. Every friend is the peddler of slander. Each cheats his friend, never telling the truth. They have trained their tongues to lie. They have devoted all their energy to doing wrong. Verse 6, you live in a world of bad faith. Out of bad faith they refuse to know me, the Lord declares. That phrase, bad faith, that I read in my translation is repeated at least 3 times in about 3 verses. What's that word in your translation?
Deceit.
It says deceit or deception again. And so the Lord declares, verse 7, I'll now purge them and test them. There is no other way to treat the daughter of my people. Their tongue is a deadly arrow. Their words are in bad faith. With his mouth each wishes his neighbor peace, while in his heart he plots a trap for him. Shall I fail to punish them for this, the Lord demands? Shall I, on such a nation, fail to exact vengeance? This is awful. And Jeremiah is trying to say things to his people that are awful. We're not quite far enough to see everything that he's doing, but we're seeing some of it. Verse 13. Why did all this happen? They forsook my law. Forsook, isn't that a great word? Mine says forsaken, but somehow it seems better to say forsook. I don't get to say that very often. They have not listened to my voice or followed it. Instead, you can hear the Bible say, they have followed their own stubborn hearts. They have followed the Baals as their ancestors taught them. And so what's coming is wormwood to eat and poisoned water to drink. I will scatter them among nations unknown to their ancestors or to them. I will pursue them with the sword until I've annihilated them. And everything that follows is lament. Verse 22 speaks of human corpses strewn like dung in the open field, like sheaves left by the reaper with no one to gather them. And all of a sudden, in verse 23, something comes out shining like the sun. And you almost don't know where it came from. And it's so powerful, I underlined it. And if you've got a pen that doesn't bleed through, you might want to do that too. The Lord says this, "Let not the sage boast of wisdom, nor the valiant of valor, nor the wealthy of riches." If anybody wants to boast, here's what they ought to boast about: of understanding and knowing me. For I am the Lord who acts with faithful love, with justice and uprightness on the earth. And people who do that please me, the Lord declares. Boast not in wisdom. Boast not in valor. Boast not in riches. You want to boast about something? Boast of understanding and knowing me. Faithful love. You guys remember the Hebrew word that comes from? I've been trying to teach it to you about once a month, once every 6 weeks. I try to find an excuse to remind you of this. Has it stuck yet? I didn't think so. The word is hesed. H-E-S-E-D. H-E-S-E-D. Hesed. Translated, my translation, faithful love. Middle of verse 24, for I am the Lord who acts with faithful love. Whatever word you have right there, that's hesed. And hesed is somewhere that ties up the New Testament concepts of agape, mercy, and grace. Just to be sure, what's mercy? Mercy is God not giving me what I deserve to get. What is grace? God giving me the things I don't deserve to get. And what's agape? The kind of love that acts. It's active love. It's not emotional. It's not feeling. It's active love. The days are coming, verse 25, when I will punish all who are circumcised only in the flesh. And Egypt, along with Judah, and Edom, and Ammon, and Moab, and all the men with shaven temples who live in the desert, those are false priests. For all those nations and the whole house of Israel too are uncircumcised at heart. The mark of Jewish people has been circumcision for hundreds of years. But even back in Deuteronomy, it talks about be circumcised in the heart. Something of a transformation or a change inside rather than something external. My plan was to get through chapter 14 today. I often have ambitious plans. My plan was to get to the point where you see something and you have a chance to get involved with one of the controversies that's going on right now. You may not know about this controversy. There's a verse coming in Jeremiah 29:11 that starts, I know the plans I have for you. What's the rest of that verse? Remember all those pieces? Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. You remember that? Okay. There's a debate going on in religious circles about the meaning of that verse. Because it's being used to say to people, you're supposed to be rich and God has a plan to make you rich. And there are people who are saying this verse is not written to individuals. This verse is written to a group. It's written to a specific group. A group of people who have disobeyed to a level that they're about to be destroyed. What's going to happen to the individuals in this group? They're going to be in exile for 70 years before they come back. What's going to happen to the people in this group? Most of them are going to die. There's going to be a few who come back who were there when they were taken away, but not many. There's going to be a few. There's evidence in Ezra and Nehemiah. We'll see that evidence when we get there. There's a few who remember before the exile came. But for the most part, what's going to happen with these people is grim. But the people as a whole have a hope in the future. And how do you make sense of that? If you start applying that verse to an individual, some of the people say, you're misusing that verse. You're misseeing what it is. It's talking to a group, not to an individual. I don't know what I think about this yet, but I've started to listen to this a little bit. And I invite you to do the same as we head towards that. Jeremiah is going to be telling the people, this is what I want you to look for. What's your assignment for next time? Start at chapter 10. Read the rest of Jeremiah. I hope you do that this time. That would be a remarkably good thing. And what are you looking for? You're looking for the big messages that Jeremiah is giving. And the big message is, you're about to have the world crash in on you. And many of you are going to die. And the ones who don't are going to be taken and made slaves. You're going to be transported to some far distant place. And here's the key. Almost all the time, when that happens, you lose your identity. And Jeremiah says, that's the one thing God says. As you go through this punishment, as you go through this purification, don't lose your identity. Because there's going to come a time when God's going to gather up the remnant and bring them back. And when they come back in Ezra and Nehemiah, idolatry is no longer a problem. You don't see it at all. That's gone. And Jeremiah is trying to prepare the people for that. People don't want to hear it. The leaders don't want to hear it. All kinds of conflict that comes. But I want you to watch for that message. We're going to see the details. We're looking at a lower level than that. But I want you to watch for that overall. That's all we have time for today, except that Willie has his hand up, and Willie doesn't often have his hand up.
The conditions for which he made those promises, I think, were for those who loved him unconditionally and faithfully and continued to do that. In the sermon today, we saw how it was brought down to such a simple state. He says, have you lied? Have you stolen? And the simplicity of that, this bad fiction, makes it very difficult to say that you love him unconditionally.
I want to take it a step further. Some of you who know the hymns as they used to be, there was a word change in one of the hymns, one of the verses of one of the hymns today. And that word change took away a very powerful principle. I sang it the old way. You need to go look. You need to go look. Go back and look at that hymn and think about what it used to say. It took away those who love me, those who follow me, those who obey me. They will be the ones that I put my favor on. It took that away. And it just said, I'm going to give my favor to everybody. That's a shift, folks. I don't want to make a big deal out of it, but if you're going to raise that point, it's not just the sermon that asks that question, but there's a place in one of the hymns that sort of says, well, maybe it's not. And that's the debate that's going on about Jeremiah 29:11, and I invite you to listen to that debate a little bit. Listen. I'm not reminded. I've got to go back and look at the hymnals. It wasn't trust and obey. And it wasn't come ye sinners, poor and needy. So it must have been crown him with many crowns. Yep. Maybe third verse, maybe second verse. I don't remember. I'll go back and look. I'll know a little better. But it brought me up short. It brought me up short. And that's one of the, I don't know if you know, there's a songwriter who was asked to change the words of his hymn so that it could be included in some big hymnal someplace, and he refused. He said, no, I've written it correctly, and I don't want to change those words. That's another debate that's running, and you might not be aware of that. Yes, sir?
They changed those words in our hymnal.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, they changed those words, too, for that in this hymnal.
Oh, I hadn't spotted that. I thought they had refused to give permission.
The workers were, and the wrath of God was satisfied.
Right.
And they wanted him to change it to the love of God was magnified, and he refused.
Right.
But in our current hymnal, they have changed those words.
Well, I didn't realize. I thought they refused permission. Okay. There are debates running. I invite you to read this with some awareness of what's happening. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time we've had today. We thank you that even though we went through two very rough chapters, at the end we see something important. And we remember that our brother Paul, when he wrote, picked up this thing, same idea. I will not boast in anything except that you love me. And you've made yourself known to me. And now I walk in the light of that knowledge. Help us realize how dependent we are on you. Help us give voice and give action to our gratitude for your favor and your love for us, for your grace and your mercy and your love. For we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.